Cassette 4, Side 2. Oh my God, he thought. I've got MDR. His wife Didi had begun her studies in Paris. So for now, when he was in Boston, Farmer still camped in the basement of the PIH building. PIHers called it the cave. He woke up there in the middle of the night, bathed in sweat, thinking, if I do have MDR, I've exposed all my patients to it. He went to a radiologist friend, swore him to secrecy, and had his chest x-rayed. He studied the film. It was normal. He called Didi in Paris at least once a day. She told him over the phone, you must go to a doctor. Look, I am a doctor. Let me finish the month at the Brigham and go to Haiti. Then I'll rest. He finally made the diagnosis on the morning of his last day of Brigham service. The night before, he'd turned down pizza, and that morning the smell of coffee nauseated him. Classic for hepatitis, he thought. Revulsion at foods you love. In the bathroom, he saw that his urine was dark. Oh, no, I do have hepatitis. Which kind? B? No, I've been vaccinated. Not C, I don't do drugs. A? But how? He'd discovered ceviche in Lima. Perhaps he had eaten some tainted fish. When he got to the Brigham, he stopped at the lab and asked them to do tests on him at once. He stayed around to see the first result. His red blood count. It's way out of whack, he thought. He felt dehydrated, so while the other lab results were still pending, he called Jim Kim on the house phone. Jim was back in Boston, too, managing a floor at the Brigham. Jim, I'm coming up to your unit. I need fluids. Then Farmer lay down in his suit in one of the rooms on Jim's floor, feeling rather cheerful. After the IV nurse rehydrated him, he got off the bed and joined the infectious disease specialist he was training, a young woman. Marla, he told her, I feel worse. Let's do rounds early. Marla was usually impatient with him. She'd interrupt his constant in-hospital socializing, saying, Farmer, shut up. Let's get working. Now she said, you're psycho. Let someone take over for you. Marla, I finished today. She went away scowling. He went into a patient's room and was in the midst of diagnosing a case of acute prostatitis. It was obvious when Marla returned. Her face looked blanched, he thought. Paul, your liver functions are so high the machine couldn't do them. They had to dilute it. All right, I give up. He went back to the room in Jim's unit, got into a Johnny, and surrendered himself to illness. Hepatitis A is only rarely fatal, but his case was severe. Jim and some other doctors worried that he might need a liver transplant. Farmer was so sick for a time that he could hardly make his voice audible. Nevertheless, a few nights after he took to his hospital bed, a young PIHer got a call from him, a tiny, squeaky voice issuing instructions about drug procurement for Peru. When he got out of the hospital 2 weeks later, Ophelia sent him and Didi to a hotel in southern France, Paul's first real vacation in years. 9 months later, he had a daughter named Catherine. So everything turned out all right. But hearing him tell the story, I wondered at his recklessness. At the Brigham, he'd been preaching the importance of hepatitis A vaccination, especially for middle-aged people. He told me, I was embarrassed. But only, it seemed, for failing to get the shot, not for ignoring his symptoms during an entire month. He hadn't told Ophelia or his mother he was sick, and I wondered if that was because he knew they would try to make him stop working. Doctors are notorious for taking peculiar views of their own bodies. They tend to develop hypochondria in medical school and, once they get over it, if they do, tend to think they're invulnerable. Many people refuse to set their work aside for matters of personal convenience, but Farmer seemed to be unwilling to set it aside for any reason. It was as if he couldn't allow himself to be the one to set it aside. A force stronger than his own will had to intervene, like the car that had hit him back in 1988. Speaking of his bout of hepatitis, Farmer told me, if I get sick, it'll be nearly fatal. He was drawing a contrast between himself and the world's poor. A generous thought, but his habit of disregarding his health hardly seemed like a way of expressing pragmatic solidarity. Given the responsibilities for other lives he'd taken on, it seemed to me he'd done the opposite. On the other hand, at some point, I'm not sure exactly when, I realized that I'd become inclined to hold Farmer to a higher standard than I did most people, including myself. And as a rule, to see him in action was to excuse him. The MDR project was making progress with patients, and the Peruvian TB doctors had noticed. Accordingly, Farmer and Kim were making progress with them. One day, when it was clear that the project was succeeding, I followed Farmer to an appointment at the Children's Hospital in downtown Lima. When he emerged from the noisy, smoky traffic jam in front of the hospital, a small entourage of Peruvian medical people rushed out to claim him, then hurried him past the men hawking toilet paper and balloons and newspapers, then past the armed guard at the front door. Farmer was, I figured from the fuss, medico aventurero no more around here. He looked worried, though. Or maybe I only imagined this, thinking he ought to be. He and Jim and Jaime had tried hard to establish collegial relations with the Peruvian medical establishment, and now, because of traffic, he'd kept a group of proud doctors waiting over an hour for him. Farmer pulled a stethoscope out of the pocket of his rumpled black suit jacket and draped it over his neck as we entered a maze of narrow, concrete-walled corridors, the hospital's tuberculosis wing. He was walking fast. Then, all of a sudden, he stopped. A family of three stood in the hallway up ahead, a little boy and his mother and father. The mother was slender and wore a skirt and a T-shirt with a picture of Mickey Mouse on the front. She hung back, half hidden around a corner, while the father came forward. Farmer and the father opened their arms simultaneously and bear-hugged each other. "In my culture, we don't shake hands," Farmer was always telling me, trying to reform me in this way, too, I'd begun to feel. Hurriedly, he asked for news of the child. The little boy was chubby, obviously healthy. He stood close to his father. When Farmer crouched down and held out his arms, the child came forward on his own stubby legs in a rolling, waddling gait, giggling as he advanced headlong toward Farmer, then turning around and waddling back toward his father. A happy-looking dance. "Christian, look at you!" cried Farmer. His face had turned bright red. He wore the wild-looking grin with which he greeted old friends. He turned to me. "This was a terrible case," he said in a low voice, in English. Nearly 2 years ago, a doctor from this hospital had called Jaime Bayona at Socios headquarters and said, "We have a child here you have to help us with." By the time of that phone call, Christian had been lying in bed for months. Jen Furin, the Harvard medical student who worked with Sonia in Caraballo, went to the hospital. The child she found there was 3 years old and weighed only about 22 pounds. He labored to breathe, and the oxygen mask had made sores around his nose. Tuberculosis had invaded both his lungs. It had begun eating his spine, and it had fractured the long bones of his legs. He had gone through the 6 months of standard short-course chemotherapy. Then the lab had cultured his TB and found it resistant to several drugs. Christian was being given those same drugs when Jen arrived. The doctors were obeying Las Normas, applying the WHO retreatment plan. Jen had done most of the actual doctoring. Farmer had devised the regimen for Christian. He'd talked about the case to both Peruvian and American TB experts, but no one in the world knew much about treating children with second-line drugs. Here was the received wisdom. You can't use fluoroquinolones or ethambutol at high doses in kids. Where did this come from? Fluoroquinolones cause cartilage damage in immature beagle pups. High-dose ethambutol is associated with optic neuritis and loss of color vision in a small proportion of adults. But kids can't report loss of color vision, so it shouldn't be used. This was a big part of the discussion, and here was a child literally wasting away, his flesh and bones consumed by MDR, in front of our eyes. Farmer proposed an empiric regimen, a regimen based on his best guesses, which consisted of high-dose ethambutol and four second-line drugs, including a fluoroquinolone. To get official approval, he told the Peruvian doctors that he'd discussed the matter with every world-renowned expert and studied the pediatric literature. This was true. He didn't say that the pediatric literature contained nothing at all about treating MDR. It was a matter of merely applying infectious disease knowledge, he would tell me. He based the dosing on the drug manufacturer's recommendations, which had nothing to say about children, but advised the use of so many milligrams of drug per so many kilograms of body weight. He'd often done this with other pediatric illnesses in Haiti. He recommended a very aggressive course of second-line drugs for Christian. Too aggressive, said some of the American doctors he consulted, who, I might add, had never treated a baby with MDR. The Peruvians had no experience with such cases either. They accepted Farmer's recommendation. The child was clearly dying and in agony, so why not try it? Farmer had learned through email that Christian was coming along well, but he hadn't known how well until this moment in the hall at the children's hospital. The child could actually run. Farmer grinned, and a blush spread from his high forehead and over his neck and, I imagined, down past his necktie toward his feet, as the child waddled around, giggling in front of him. And the father beamed down at the child, and the mother peered out from around the corner, smiling, too. Then it was over. Christian's wasn't the main case Farmer had been asked to consult on today. He was making this hospital visit on Jaime Bayona's instructions as a favor to a Peruvian TB doctor whose own daughter was sick. Farmer's escorts shepherded him into an office. A whitewashed ceiling, concrete walls, a team of doctors, and a little girl in a dress. A string of X-rays and CT films were mounted in a viewer along one wall, pictures of the interior of the little girl's chest. Farmer made apologies for his lateness to the doctors, bowing a little at the waist, and then turned with them to the films. The little girl had pulmonary TB. Infiltrates. Not good, Farmer said in Spanish to the doctors. He studied the report from the Massachusetts State Lab. It was unequivocal. I looked over his shoulder at the sheet of paper, a list of the 5 first-line antibiotics with the letter R for resistant next to each one. The child, the doctor's daughter, had gone through DOTS and was now several months into the retreatment regimen. That is, she was being treated with all 5 of those same drugs. This is terrible, Farmer murmured to me in English from the side of his mouth. He knelt down and listened through his stethoscope to the girl's lungs. Then, smiling, he looked up at her father and said, "She has asthma, just like me. She's adorable, like my Catherine." Then Farmer stood and began a long spiel in Spanish, directed to the little girl's father and the other doctors. "I do not know more than this medical team, my esteemed colleagues here. She has wheezing and a worsening CT scan since February. It's worrisome." He reviewed the options. They could perform a new laboratory analysis on the chance that the Massachusetts State Lab had made a mistake, even though it had a nearly flawless record, well certified. Or they could wait and monitor the child's condition, even though it was getting worse. Or they could trust the lab work, abandon the DOTS retreatment regimen, and begin giving her Farmer's own favorite pediatric regimen of second-line drugs. He preferred this last course, he said. "This is my prejudice." He smiled some more at the doctors. "As you know, from our experience together working shoulder to shoulder." The room seemed full of strong feeling, covered with professional courtesy. The little girl's father stood behind his daughter. He maintained a smile throughout. He kept his shoulders erect. He was trying hard, it seemed to me, to hold on to his professional composure. He was a TB doctor, after all. But when Farmer spoke to him about his daughter, the man reached out to touch her shoulders, and he seemed to hold his breath. "He knew," Jaime Bayona would tell me later. "He knew for months that she had MDR." But the man hadn't dared go against the national program's strict normas. One could imagine his reasons. He would have been risking his job, and jobs like his were hard enough to come by in Peru that to risk it would be to risk the survival of his entire family. Jaime had taken matters into his own hands. He'd had the girl's sputum sent to Boston, circumventing the national lab, and when the results had come back, her father, an old friend, had begged Jaime. Begged, Jaime insisted, that Farmer examine her, because Farmer's opinions had weight now with a lot of Peruvian doctors. The father had known beforehand that Farmer would prescribe second-line therapy, and so had the assembled doctors. "They were just waiting for Paul to pronounce," Jaime would say later on. Indeed, soon afterward the doctors would place the girl on Farmer's regimen, and she would begin to recover, suffering few side effects. So the consult was really just a charade. Farmer played out the rest of his part with aplomb. He promised to send his report and recommendations to the father by email. He ticked off the reasons for optimism on his fingers. It is possible she may still have rifabutin on her side. She's in good shape. She has only a little lung damage. Her resistance isn't total. We are ready to help you in any way that we can. Soon, with many thank yous and bowings and scrapings and warmest wishes to their beautiful wives and distinguished husbands, Farmer departed. On the way out of the hospital, he said, speaking of the little girl, "The child is wheezing and has a worsening CT. She's on all five first-line drugs, and she's resistant to all of them. And I had to say, I wonder why she isn't getting better, and go through the pathophysiology instead of saying, 'What's the matter with you people?' They don't want to believe in MDR. The delicate thing is, you want to make progress with them. Insult them and forget it. They want to do the right thing. They're just following instructions from on high. But Christian, the little boy in the hall, made an eloquent argument for adding flexibility to the normas. 'A couple more cases like Christian's and they'll come around,' Farmer was saying as we walked across the parking lot toward the socio's car. Then, turning to open his door, Farmer saw Christian's mother, the woman in the Mickey Mouse shirt. She had followed him at a distance. Now she approached, lowered her eyes, and said in Spanish, 'I want to say many thanks.' Farmer looked away, just a quick glance to left and right. I'd seen him do this in patients' rooms at the Brigham. Look at the patient, then glance up at the TV for a moment, then return, as if disconnecting, so as to reconnect fully. He gazed at the woman and pursed his lips and said softly in Spanish, 'For me, it is a privilege.'" Chapter 18. In April 1998, a special meeting of TB was convened at the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in Boston, a meeting to present early results from the small MDR treatment project in Peru. The meeting was Howard Hyatt's idea. Socios was now treating more than 100 people with MDR in the northern slums of Lima. They had been treating the first 53 for the better part of 2 years, and the results were in. It appeared that more than 85% were cured. Their patients were younger on average and had fewer accompanying illnesses than Dr. Eisman's in Denver, and as with many diseases, youthfulness and the absence of comorbidity were therapeutic advantages. Even so, the cure rate was remarkable. "An astonishing result," Howard Hyatt had said. "The world must hear this news," he'd declared. He hoped, among other things, that if the right people heard it, PIH might be able to secure new financing for their project. A lot of the world's ranking tuberculosis experts had agreed to come to the meeting, including Arata Kochi, the head of WHO's TB program. Farmer had cultivated him. Equally important, Kochi had been a student of Hyatt's at the Harvard School of Public Health. Kochi had labored for years to sell DOTS to the world, and as I understood his motives, he felt he had to quell the bad publicity Farmer had begun stirring up. Before the meeting, he had decided that WHO should probably have a strategy that included MDR treatment in places where there was significant drug resistance. One of his staff had come up with a new, catchy term, DOTS Plus. Some years after the event, Arata Kochi told me in his clipped English, Japanese is his native tongue, "MDR is basically because of human errors. If you can't treat it right, don't do it. Secondly, many country can't afford. Difficult, expensive. And of course we use MDR as kind of a scare tactics. But in program review in South Africa we found 34% of whole TB budget for a few cases of MDR, and they had a lousy DOTS program. We said, use your money for DOTS. Then Paul Farmer came. A very different approach. Similar to HIV activists. All good clinicians without significant public health experience. Patient in front of me is the most important thing. An unsolvable conflict. They are very articulate, and issue is very emotional. How to react? Tremendous challenge for me. These guys, they are screaming. They want to shoot us. Politically, we have to respond positively. Same time, we have to start dialogue. Cauchy used the term DOTS plus in his opening remarks at the meeting. That's brilliant. That's great, Jim Kim told him later over cocktails. So Farmer and Kim got some of what they hoped for from TB before the meeting even started. Speaking about all this some years later, Cauchy smiled and said, DOTS plus. The world is changing. We have to change too. If you cannot beat them, join them. He added, then, to some extent, we can control them. Cauchy had made a strategic concession. In effect, he'd made MDR treatment discussable. But the discussion itself was just beginning. When panels on international health gather, whether in Switzerland, Indonesia, or Boston, they occupy one place and atmosphere. A room with a huge table or many tables made into a giant rectangle, bottled water, and name cards at each seat. Over the rattle of coffee cups to the shuffle and click of the slide projector, the experts read their prepared remarks, technical terms and acronyms abounding. Now and then, old saws. Don't let perfect be the enemy of good. In the corridors and hallways outside the lecture rooms, you might, for instance, hear an Italian TB expert say of a Canadian one, I'm going to physically aggress him. But inside the rooms, calm usually prevails. It's easy to drift away on the voices, imagining colors in the accents, pinks and purples from the Caribbean and the Indian subcontinent, black and white from Japan, and forget that what is really going on is the writing of prescriptions that may affect the lives of billions. Hyatt presided, tall and thin, uttering the opening remarks at his usual deliberate pace, as if his tongue weighed every word. The atmosphere was civil, but there were a few heated discussions on scientific issues. An argument of a different sort began on the afternoon of the first day of the meeting, when a bearded man named Alex Goldfarb leaned over his microphone and said in sonorously accented English, So, Russia is a TB nightmare. Goldfarb was a rumpled-looking microbiologist, a former refusnik in the latter days of the Soviet Union. He was working now for the Soros Foundation on the TB epidemic in Russia. 100,000 of that country's prison inmates had active TB, Goldfarb said, and most, if not all, were being treated with the worst possible regimen, with a single drug, because the government hadn't come up with the money to buy more. So, it is a nightmare. So most of these 100,000 inmates will probably die without ever knowing whether they have MDR-TB or not. His group was trying to sort things out and implement some sort of rational approach. They were setting up demonstration projects, DOTS projects, in several places. There was no telling yet how many Russians had MDR, but it was certain the percentage in the prisons was high. Now, what to do with these cases? Goldfarb asked. He answered, I do not have the slightest idea. He turned to Farmer, and I would very much like to know how much drugs did you use for your 53 cases and how much did they cost? We can probably try to implement MDR treatment, at least in prison. I don't think it can be done in the community in Russia, but in prison at least, if there is money. But the question is the cost. Farmer mustered the best case he could, but in the end, he had to name the real figures. I'm not saying that it's not expensive. It's been very costly. I'm not saying that it's not going to be difficult. But I will say, as Dr. Bayona has suggested, that we have managed to overcome those obstacles for that small number of patients, and that leads me to believe that it would be possible ultimately. A PIH ally raised her hand. Costs would only rise if the world delayed in taking on MDR, she said. But another expert said, I'm not sure that no matter how compelling a case that this group or any other group makes, there's going to be all of a sudden an outpouring of money to treat. Others raised their voices. Another PIH ally declared, I don't think this is a conference of donors, so I don't think we should be expected to come out of this with pledges, but to say that this is something that the world should pay attention to. I remember signing the oath to assist the patient and do him no harm. I don't really remember signing that I would do it in a cost-effective way. There was scattered applause from the young PIHers in the room. Then Goldfarb spoke up again, his voice calm and acidic.
I want to share with you a simple reality. I have $6 million. With $3 million, I can implement DOTS for 5,000 Russian prison inmates. And assuming that 10% have MDR-TB, 4,500 will be cured and 500 will go down with MDR-TB and die. And there's nothing much you can do. So, I have a choice. And my choice is to use another $3 million to treat the 500 with MDR-TB, or go to another region and treat another 5,000. I'm working with limited resources, so my choice is not involved in the human rights of 500 people, but 500 people versus 5,000 people. And this is a very practical question for me, because I have $6 million. And the second question is that if I disclose to the Russian people that I spent $6,000 per case in MDR-TB in the prisons, with tens of thousands of people dying all around, they will tell me that I am building a golden palace for a selected few. So for those of us who have to make those decisions with limited resources, it's a very serious question.
There was consternation in the room. Hyatt had to bang the gavel. He asked Goldfarb if he couldn't see his way to using some of Soros's money, in a pilot project perhaps, to address the question of how MDR affected DOTS.
Well, I'm sorry, Goldfarb retorted. I have to comment. When we talk about Mr. Kochi, who's not doing an experiment but whose job is to try to control TB globally, there is a different set of priorities. I can't afford doing a pilot project. We're not doing a pilot project.
My understanding, said Hyatt pleasantly, is that my former student, Dr. Kochi, is thinking about control of tuberculosis, not just in 1998 and 99 because he recognizes that he's not going to control the problem worldwide, but is thinking about controlling the problem over the next decade or decades. The young PIHers glared at Goldfarb, but he'd made an argument that they'd have to answer, sooner or later. Jim Kim tried rhetoric first in the opening speech the next day. Many people had asked him, he told the crowd, why a little organization like PIH had taken on such a costly and difficult task in Peru. They were right to wonder. We actually had to make a choice that we would not feed 4,000 more children in Haiti, perhaps. And if any of you have been to Haiti, there's hardly anything more morally compelling than the situation of landless peasants in the Central Plateau. But, Jim went on, they'd had a dream. The dream that someday we might sit in this room, that there might be a TB All-Star Weekend. He said, we took on this project because we thought that by proving that one could do community-based treatment of multi-drug-resistant TB, that we might have the opportunity to work with a room full of people like you, to actually expand resources to a problem that afflicts the populations we serve. Other speakers had talked about the need to generate political will for treating TB, as if each country had to solve its own problem. But, Jim said, political will was hardly the issue in a place such as Zaire, whose most recent president had stolen about 30% of the money loaned by foreign governments and the World Bank. For places like Zaire, money to deal with TB and MDR-TB would have to come from elsewhere. There are more billionaires today than ever before, Jim declared. We are talking about wealth that we've never seen before, and the only time that I hear talk of shrinking resources among people like us, among academics, is when we talk about things that have to do with poor people. The PIH project in Peru could be replicated, and some of what was needed were endorsements from academics with clout and the support of the TB community. Jim said, and let me just conclude this, my brief remarks here at this TB All-Star Weekend, by paraphrasing someone of our tribe, of Paul's tribe, and my tribe of anthropologists. Margaret Mead once said, never underestimate the ability of a small group of committed individuals to change the world. He paused. Indeed, they are the only ones who ever have. Chapter 19. Many of the policymakers in TB control had now heard the case, the fine clinical results from Peru, and the epidemiological evidence that DOTS would fail in a setting of substantial drug resistance. The meeting had also produced, of course, a committee to study the feasibility of DOTS Plus programs, but the arguments about treating MDR were far from over. In international health near the turn of the 21st century, a mentality nearly opposite to Jim Kim's optimism prevailed. It borrowed from the 19th century utilitarian philosophers, from the notion that one should provide the greatest good for the greatest number, and it was expressed in a language of realism. The world had limited resources. Nations whose resources weren't just limited but scarce had to make the best possible uses of the little they had. Other countries and international institutions might help out, but these days, if you wanted money from big donors for health projects in poor countries, if you wanted to be taken seriously, your proposals had to pass a test called cost-effectiveness analysis. The general technique was used first in engineering, later on in war and medicine. You calculated the cost of a public health project or medical procedure and tried to quantify its effectiveness. Then you compared the results for competing projects or procedures. Farmer and Kim made similar calculations when trying to decide what to do next in Kanj. But it seemed to them that the high councils in international health often used this analytic tool to rationalize an irrational status quo. MDR treatment was cost-effective in a place like New York, but not in a place like Peru. By the time of the meeting in Boston, the project in Peru had begun to establish a new paradigm. It was a challenge to the uses of cost-effective analysis not only philosophically, but also factually. The World Health Organization had declared MDR treatment largely ineffective, but not on the basis of any substantial trials. Now Kim and Farmer and Jaime Bayona and the others in Socios had proven that effective treatment was possible, even in a slum in a relatively poor country. Experts in TB control had declared MDR treatment inordinately costly, but no one had tried to reduce the main expense, which was high-priced drugs. Shortly after the Boston meeting, Jim Kim went to WHO headquarters in Geneva. No one he talked to there even knew that the patents on all but one class of the second-line antibiotics had expired years ago. And no one there seemed very interested when he declared, "We can drive down the prices by 90% to 95%. Jim didn't know exactly how to make that happen. Make the assertion, then figure out the means. This was his strategy. The big shot strategy, Farmer called it approvingly. Jim was born in South Korea and grew up in Muscatine, Iowa, in the 1970s. For as long as he could remember, the place had seemed too small for his ambitions. He hardly noticed the Mississippi flowing by the lovely old downtown, or the fragrances of grains on summer nights, or even the famous local produce, the Muscatine melon. He detasseled corn only once. But like every schoolboy in town, he knew Mark Twain had praised Muscatine for its sunsets, and didn't know for decades that Twain had said this only to make a joke about his sleeping habits. The sunrises are also said to be exceedingly fine. I do not know. Jim's father had schemed and charmed his way out of North Korea and become, proudly, Muscatine's periodontist, with an office upstairs on Main Street. Jim's mother had come from South Korea. A grandfather had served as a minister to the last Korean king, and she had studied at Union Theological Seminary with Reinhold Niebuhr and Paul Tillich and become a Confucian scholar, and ended up for many years a housewife in Muscatine. A small, elegant woman, walking across the local golf course when her children were too young to play alone, diligently trying to make sense of American sports so she could understand her children's milieu. At every opportunity, she took Jim and his siblings to Des Moines and Chicago so they'd know the world was larger than it seemed from Muscatine. She taught her three children, by example, the arts of debate, around the kitchen table, while her husband, who had early morning appointments, went to bed grumbling that he didn't know what they had to talk about that was more important than a good night's sleep. She'd tell them to live as if for eternity, and tutor them on current events, translating for Jim the images of famine and war that upset him on the TV news. Early on, Jim imagined himself becoming a doctor to treat such suffering, and excelling in science quickened his interest. He was quarterback on the Muscatine High football team, a starting guard in basketball, the president of his class and its valedictorian. But the Kims were the only Asian family in town, except for the one that owned the Chinese restaurant. When they went to the malls of Iowa, adults stared and children followed them around, the bolder ones approaching, crying out, "Ki-ai!" and making as if to deliver karate chops. For Jim, embarrassment at his parents' Koreanness was the loneliest feeling of all. "Go, Hawkeye!" his father, booster of all things Iowan, would cry, Koreanizing the cheer for the University of Iowa's sports teams. Jim would correct him. "No, Dad, it's Hawkeyes." He went to the University of Iowa and felt liberated there until he was told that Ivy League schools were better. He transferred to Brown, where he discovered an organization called the Third World Center. He became its director. He broke up with his Irish Catholic girlfriend because he suddenly believed he shouldn't date white women. He made his friends among black, Hispanic, and Asian students. He learned the pimp walk. On parents' weekend, he and his friends would dress up in black and stride around the campus, a phalanx of about 30 African-American and Hispanic students, and one Korean, sometimes chanting, sometimes maintaining a threatening silence, and noting with pleasure the double takes and frightened looks on the faces of some of the parents. Before Brown, Jim hadn't known that the United States interned Japanese Americans during World War II. He read up on the subject, then lectured about it. He embraced the idea of Asian racial solidarity. He didn't realize back then just how complex a matter this could be. He didn't find out until much later that, for example, Koreans were supposed to hate the Japanese. From time to time, doubts cropped up. It seemed as if, for other Asians at Brown, racial identity meant little more than eating with chopsticks and finding an Asian mate, and the paramount political issue seemed to be the glass ceiling, the fact that Asians weren't yet rising to the very tops of institutions. But the idea of being a member of an oppressed minority was very alluring. Jim decided to learn his native language. "I wanted to learn Korean, be down with my people, be an authorized third world person, so I could say shit." He got a fellowship to travel to Seoul and happened on an interesting story for his PhD thesis in anthropology. It had to do with the Korean pharmaceutical industry. In Seoul, he did his research and made a mighty effort to fit in, hanging out at bars with new Korean friends and performing karaoke. Beforehand, on each occasion, he'd go to the bathroom and study the words to songs like My Way. He had left Iowa prepared, naturally enough, to think that ethnicity was the central problem of his life. By the time he came back from Korea to Harvard to continue medical school and write his thesis, he had grown bored and a little disgusted with what was known in academic circles as the politics of racial identity. It seemed like an exercise in selfishness. "I discovered South Korea was doing just fine, and that what Koreans wanted was for me to write grant proposals so they could come to the States and get degrees. I had looked at student movements. They were all about Korean nationalism, just sort of troublemaking." When he met Farmer, he was ready to change directions. At one point during their talks in the old one-room PIH office, Farmer told him, "If you come to Haiti, I'll show you you're a blanc, as white as any white man." Jim thought of his black, Hispanic, and Asian friends at Brown, and how angry that remark would have made them. He told Farmer that he felt liberated from the self-hatred and evasion of ethnicity he'd felt in Muscatine. "It's good to have to come to understandings of that, but you've got to put that behind you now," said Farmer. "So what are you going to do? Be the first Asian to do some stupid thing like walk on the moon?" They hadn't talked long before Jim declared that he wanted to make Farmer's preferential option for the poor his own life's work. All his life, it seemed, Jim had been jumping at the next new thing, the bigger and better thing. Perhaps this was the residue of growing up in Muscatine with a cosmopolitan mother. "You're not Korean. You're Karine," Ophelia told him once. Jim himself said, "I tend to feel a problem solved once I've thought it through." Then again, He was fond of overstatement, even when talking about himself. After all, he'd stuck with PIH for a decade by now and done a lot of its most menial chores along the way. What Jim had, above all, was enthusiasm. He'd weigh facts against possibilities as if the two were equivalent. A lot of students had joined PIH after hearing him talk. Change the world? Of course they could. He really believed this, and he really believed that a small group of committed individuals could do it. He liked to say of PIH, "People think we're unrealistic. They don't know we're crazy." From his research in Korea, Jim already knew that the price of a drug may have little to do with its usefulness or the costs of manufacturing and distributing it. Often the price is high because only one company makes it. A firm can secure this monopoly power through patents. But that wasn't the case with the second-line TB drugs. In the world, perhaps as many as 750,000 people suffered from MDR. Treating all of them would require a large quantity of drugs because treatment lasted so long. So the potential market was big, but most people with the disease were poor, so actual demand was small. Not many companies made the drugs. Those that did could pretty much name their price. Eli Lilly and the second-line drug Capriomycin, for instance. After long badgering from Pharmer, that company was finally selling PIH Caprio in Peru for $21 a vial. Pharmer and Kim had bought the same drug, made by Lilly, for $29.90 a vial at the Brigham in Boston. Then they had discovered that it cost only $8.80 in Paris. So they'd tried to buy Caprio in Paris, but were told they couldn't. "There's a global shortage of Caprio," the drug agent in Paris had told Pharmer over the phone. "Why?" Pharmer asked. "There seems to be an emergency." "Where?" "In Peru." Jim went to Howard Hyatt and told him the story. "Looks like price gouging to me," Hyatt said. In fact, so-called differential pricing was standard in the world of large drug companies. Americans paid far more for their products than any other nationality. But Hyatt thought Lilly might want to pick up some good publicity by donating drugs to the project in Peru. He knew a member of Lilly's board. He and Jim went to work on the company, and meanwhile, Jim began pursuing other angles. Jim got WHO to agree to hold a meeting to encourage drug companies to produce more second-line antibiotics. He hoped to create competition, which would drive down prices. Then WHO backed out, and Jim convened the meeting himself in Boston. He wasn't above hyperbole or dramatics. At one moment, he put a list of numbers up on the slide projector, describing very large potential demand for the second-line antibiotics in order to impress the drug companies. The numbers themselves were accurate, but the demand they described wasn't real, because no one contemplating MDR treatment programs had the cash to buy the drugs. The tactic didn't work quite as Jim planned. Out in the audience, there was a Dutchman in his 20s named Guido Bakker. He worked for a non-profit company, the International Dispensary Association, IDA. It specialized in driving down the prices of essential drugs, the kinds of drugs that poor countries need most urgently. Bakker saw right through Jim's ploy, but he felt angry at the representatives from the for-profit drug companies. They started arguing that the prices for second-line TB drugs ought to remain high. Finally, Bakker announced from his seat, "IDA is going to do everything we can to lower prices by exploring generic manufacturers." The Dutch group's strategy was to ignore the giant multinational drug companies, the ones that mainly rely on research and brand names and patent protection, and to deal instead with the myriad smaller companies that make and sell at greatly reduced prices already invented generic drugs under different names, as acetaminophen instead of Tylenol in the United States, for instance. This seemed to Jim like a better idea than his own. His fondness for the new and better idea might be his salient weakness, but it sometimes served him well. He didn't care where an idea came from. He was forever reading books about corporate management, looking for tips from capitalists. He embraced Guido Bakker's plan. Ultimately, IDA and the renowned organization Doctors Without Borders would take on the task of finding generic manufacturers of second-line drugs. IDA even talked some companies into making the drugs, and they assumed responsibility for quality control and distribution. And Doctors Without Borders put up the cash to buy the first shipments. This book is continued on cassette 5.